Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger. May it please the Court, my name is Nancy Cobb, and I represent the appellant, Tailgates, Inc., in this appeal from both pretrial, trial, and post-trial matters in the Superior Court. With respect to the pretrial matters, our appeal focuses on a motion for summary judgment filed by the co-defendant, Joseph Nelson, and granted by the Superior Court on the premise that there is no civil duty to retreat from an altercation. With this in mind, I would refer the Court to the passage from Justice Cardozo quoted by Mr. Pierce in his answering brief at page 7, where Justice Cardozo noted, and I quote, "The risk reasonably to be perceived defines the duty to be obeyed." And in this instance, it is the appellant's position that a reasonable person would perceive the risk of injury to a third party given Mr. Nelson's actions. What we know about this case from the plaintiff's perspective, as was presented at trial, is that Mr. Nelson and Mr. X, an unidentified patron at Tailgates, engaged in a verbal altercation with some rather colorful language and suggestions that each other perform lewd acts. We know from Ms. Herf and from Mr. Baranowski's perspective, is that this altercation or verbal confrontation lasted somewhere between 1 and 5 minutes. We also know then that Mr. X and Mr. Nelson's confrontation escalated into a physical event. Mr. Nelson's position is that because he was not the individual who grabbed on Mr. Baranowski's ponytail and shoved him to the ground, that he therefore owes no duty to Mr. Baranowski. And it is our contention that a reasonable person would understand that, using the vernacular, getting into it with another patron, particularly one who Mr. Nelson has testified appeared intoxicated, in a crowded bar could lead to a physical altercation and injury to a third person.
Well, I'm a little confused. Even if a reasonable person would know or have reason to believe that there could be an altercation when a group of patrons at a bar are drinking a lot and exchanging words, how does that knowledge translate into some duty toward Mr. Baranowski?
Well, Justice Berger, it is our contention that Mr. Nelson was an active and willing participant in the verbal altercation and ultimately in the physical altercation. According to Mr. Baranowski, Mr. Nelson did not hightail it and run. And it is
why does that create some duty to protect Mr. Baranowski?
Actions grounded in negligence indicate that we do owe a duty to act as a reasonable person would under any circumstance. And it is our contention that a jury could have reasonably inferred that Mr. Nelson, as an active participant in the verbal altercation, as a participant in the physical aspects of the confrontation, owed a duty to those surrounding him not to allow this to occur.
I'm not sure I follow the answer. If I understand Justice Berger's question, and of course I think I do, she will happily correct me if I get it wrong. She's asking you not that we all don't understand that in order to perform a duty, you must act reasonably and not negligently in carrying out the duty that you must follow, but what creates the duty in the first instance that causes you to have to act reasonably in carrying out that duty? What is the social relationship or the situational relationship that creates the duty in the first instance?
Well, our position is Chief Justice Steele, that patronizing or being in the area in the first place does create some duty to the folks in your immediate surroundings. Now, obviously that duty has to be reined in somewhat by the foreseeability and by, as Justice Cardozo noted, the risk reasonably to be perceived.
Well, is there any authority for your contention that there's a duty that basically what you're saying is that when a group of people get together, they all have a duty to protect each other from possible injury?
I'm not indicating to protect each other, but to not affirmatively act in a way that is likely to lead to harm.
And where does, what's the case authority or other authority for that alleged duty?
I'm not aware of any case authority directly on point relative to that. Judge Del Pesco indicated that she grounded her opinion in the lack of an affirmative obligation to retreat, such as is found in the criminal statutes. And therefore, she concluded that there is no civil duty to retreat. And I'm not aware of any authority from this court or other courts which indicate that there is no civil duty to retreat under any and all circumstances.
Well, if it's not a statutory duty, it has to be a common law duty. In order for it to be a common law duty, it has to be articulated somewhere in the common law, which means case precedent.
I'm not aware.
This isn't natural law that you're referring us to find the duty, is it?
No.
It would be a very attractive argument if it was, because it would cause us to go back 150 or so years, which I'm always willing to do. But what would be the source of the duty?
I would suggest that the source of the duty lies in the definition of negligence as adopted by the courts in the Amoco Chemical case, which is just simply what negligence is. It is the failure to act as a reasonably prudent person would under those circumstances. And it's not unusual to have a situation where, never confronted with a situation, the courts have not addressed it.
How did he violate the duty that you're trying to get us to adopt?
Well, based upon what Mr. Baranowski says, Mr. Baranowski testified at both a deposition and a trial that the verbal exchange between Mr. Nelson and Mr. X, as we've been calling him, lasted somewhere between 1 minute and 5 minutes. He put it closer to 5 minutes. And in fact, that's their whole theory against tailgates, that it was the length of that altercation that should have alerted tailgates to the fact that that escalation or that confrontation could escalate.
As I understand the facts, Mr. X was making Mr. Nelson's then girlfriend, now fiance, perhaps wife, uncomfortable, and they got into this argument.
Correct.
Now, people get in arguments all the time that don't necessarily lead to violence. So in trying to use your words, kind of pare down, rein in the duty, somehow make it identifiable, can you articulate the duty that a person needs to undertake when they get into a heated argument?
From our perspective, based again on the theory that was brought against tailgates, if this verbal confrontation, this exchange of profanities, this suggestion that each do the anatomically impossible, and Mr. Nelson conceded at his deposition that he pretty much started it in terms of the verbal go-between, that when that wasn't calming down, when that was getting to the point where, according to Ms. Herf, there was a couple of turns around the pool table before there was anyone catching, before Mr. X caught Mr. Nelson. And at that point in time, from our perspective, based on the theory that's been brought against tailgates, Mr. Nelson should have recognized as an ordinary, reasonable, prudent person that this could get violent and it could get ugly, and he needed to take steps to back away. And according to Mr. Baranowski, those steps were not taken. Mr. Nelson says he just hightailed it out of there. But Mr. Baranowski tells us that there was a go-between with an exchange of punches and some pushing going on where he was in the middle. And so there was not only, as I understand Mr. Baranowski's testimony, not only willing and active participation in this verbal exchange, which at some level gives rise to.
Well, let me give you a hypothetical that gives me pause in trying to apply the rule as you articulate it. Let's suppose the two people are having a very acrimonious exchange, and the one person, Mr. Nelson in the hypothetical, realizes it could lead to violence. And Mr. Nelson said, well, that's it. I don't want to get into a fight. I'm leaving. Exactly what you say he should do. And the other person said, well, you're not leaving because based on what you said, we're going to have a fight. Now, I can see someone trying to apply your rule, making the argument that Nelson should have known he tried to withdraw in an untimely way. He shouldn't have let the verbal exchange go on for 3 minutes. It should have only gone on 30 seconds. How do you apply your rule when someone tries to extricate themselves from this violent conversation and not get into a fight and the other person won't let them?
I think that largely goes to the fact that negligence is, generally speaking, a question for a finder of fact. And in that particular case, I would submit that the duty still existed. The argument would be that the duty was discharged by attempting to leave and by taking more affirmative steps to leave. With all candor, members of the court, I'm not suggesting that the cause of action against Mr. Nelson would have been a slam dunk had this gone to a jury trial. A jury could have easily concluded that Mr. Nelson's conduct didn't violate a standard of care and wasn't the cause. Conversely, they could have also easily found that it takes two to tango. He was tangoing with the best of them, and that altercation resulted in Mr. Baranowski's injuries. In short, it's a fact for the jury to determine.
Well, let's assume that it would go to a jury. If you were the trial judge, how would you articulate in your instruction the definition of the duty that was owed that could give rise to a jury finding that the party was negligent in the way in which it did or did not discharge its duty?
In the same fashion, largely, that we instruct a jury on negligence of business owners, of patrons, of defendants and plaintiffs in all situations, that negligence is the want of ordinary care under the circumstances, and that if the jury were to conclude that an ordinary, reasonable, prudent person would have taken steps to end the verbal altercation, or in this instance, not to begin the verbal altercation.
Well, one of the simplest ways is the trial judge tells the jury, let's take the most basic, that careless driving is X and defines it from the statute. How do you define the duty here that they're supposed to examine in terms of negligent conduct? Where do you find the source for the judge to say this is the duty that X owed to Y? Then you determine whether the facts demonstrate that there was a violation of that duty resulting from careless, negligent, or intentional conduct.
In the same fashion that we instruct the
jury.
Well,
don't tell me in the same fashion. Tell me how you would do it.
Okay. As we instruct relative to business owners, that a patron in a business establishment, a spectator at a sports arena, depending on the circumstances of the case, owes a duty to comport him or herself in a fashion not likely to cause undue chance of injury to a fellow participant, patron, spectator. And that if you find that in this instance Mr. Nelson failed to discharge that obligation in any of the ways alleged, that you may find him negligent.
Okay.
The other areas for the appeal centered around some decisions made during trial, primarily with respect to the admissibility of the evidence of Mr. Johnston, a so-called expert in the area of bar security. And in this regard, it seems that the plaintiffs have taken a dual position, certainly in respect in their appellate findings or in their appellate submissions. Mr. Nitschke, in that brief, argues that Mr. Johnston's testimony is within the realm of human, of juror knowledge, and that the same would be something known to a juror. It's human nature. If that's the case, then, members of the court, Mr. Johnston's testimony was improperly admitted because it was not necessary to the jury. It constituted an impermissible lay opinion and was impermissibly clothed with the aura of an expertise when one was necessary. Conversely, if expert testimony is necessary, then Mr. Johnston, who failed to articulate a standard of care, failed to articulate in the fashion in which that standard of care was violated, other than to say that an incident occurred, his testimony did not reach the Daubert standards and should not have been admissible. I see that I am into the time reserved for rebuttal. If the court does not have any other questions, I will reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Robert Pierce representing the defendant Joseph Nelson, and I'll be addressing solely the issue of the summary judgment granted in favor of Mr. Nelson. We've agreed with Mr. Nitschke that I'll take 8 minutes and he'll take 12, but I'll take less if the court so desires. I think, from my perspective, the point where Ms. Krasinger-Cobb is missing or mixing apples with oranges is the existence of a duty as opposed to the scope or breach of the duty. The existence of the duty, which is solely a matter for the court to decide, is to this plaintiff, does the law, either through statute or through the common law, impose an obligation upon the defendant to protect the plaintiff from harm or to give some benefit to the plaintiff? And that's purely a legal question, and I haven't heard yet, and I didn't see it, hear it in the case below, how Mr. Nelson owed any duty to the plaintiff in this matter. What Mr. Nelson did was to engage in a verbal argument with Mr. X, and Mr. X apparently decided to escalate that argument. It's undisputed that the argument was going on and Mr. X charged at Mr. Nelson. It's also undisputed that Mr. Nelson ran away when that happened, and that was the only contact he had with Mr. Baranowski. Bumped into Mr. Baranowski, and Mr. Baranowski stumbled. Thereafter, Mr. Baranowski got caught between the two of them. There wasn't any, contrary to what Ms. Krasinger-Cobb said, there was no evidence that Mr. Nelson threw any punches. He was there. That wasn't when Mr. Baranowski was injured. Mr. Baranowski was injured by a distinct, discreet act by another party, that is Mr. X, when he intentionally grabbed his hair and threw him up against the wall. Mr. Baranowski stated that was when the injury took place. And I know I'm getting off into proximate cause now, but there is no duty. The only duty that was even discussed below by Tailgates or the plaintiff was the duty to retreat. I'm not aware of any duty that's been articulated in any court that there's a duty to retreat from an oral argument. And if there was such a duty, Mr. Nelson met that duty when he did, in fact, retreat, granted, when Mr. X charged at him. That's the existence of the duty. What Ms. Krasinger-Cobb is talking about is the scope of the duty, and that is to act reasonably. What do you do? Well, that is a mixed question of law and fact, but we don't get to that point under the Nadeau versus Laird case, it pretty well articulates the difference between the existence of the duty, which is purely a question of law, and the scope of the duty, which is a mixed question. So we don't get to the reasonableness of the act unless there's a duty in the first instance, and there is no duty in the first instance that's owed to the plaintiff. And that's precisely what Judge Cardozo said in the Paulsgraf case. I'm quoting, in every instance before negligence can be predicated of a given act, back of the act must be sought and found a duty to the individual complaining. And that individual complaining here is Mr. Baranowski, and the plaintiff has not identified any duty that's owed to that plaintiff. So I think it's as simple as that. The court did also rest its decision on proximate cause. Even if there is, I think it was a twofold order in that it said there was no duty and it said that there was no proximate violation of the duty that proximately caused the incident. And I think that's exactly correct, although proximate cause is definitely a question of fact. There has to be some facts supporting it, and there wasn't any fact here. Mr. Baranowski admitted he was injured at a specific point in time when his hair was grabbed by Mr. X and thrown against the wall. Mr. Nelson simply didn't have anything to do with that. The verbal argument didn't have anything to do with it. Proximate cause, as the plaintiff, as Tailgates correctly notes, is a natural and sequence of events, a continuous sequence of events, which is uninterrupted by an efficient intervening cause, and that cause results in the accident, but for which the accident would not have occurred. It cannot be reasonably argued that there was no interruption of Mr. Nelson's involvement in this altercation and the injury to Mr. Baranowski. What happened was that Mr. X, on his own, decided to change this from a verbal altercation into a physical one and charged at Mr. Nelson. That broke the sequence of events. On top of that, Mr. X then grabbed the hair and caused the injury. So under any reasonable interpretation of what is the proximate cause, there was one proximate cause. Mr. Baranowski said it himself, that he was injured when his hair was grabbed and by Mr. X and thrown against the wall. So the court had it right on both counts, no duty and no proximate cause.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good afternoon. Gary Nietzsche here on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Baranowski. I wanted to just focus on the other arguments set forth in the briefs. And if the board has questions about the first argument, I'll be more than happy to address them. But regarding the Daubert issue, members of the court, we think it was clear that Mr. Johnson had every right to testify based upon the Daubert standard. He certainly has preeminent qualifications as a security expert. He testified to those at length at the pretrial hearing. We attached his resume as an exhibit to the brief. His opinion was premised upon, or opinions were premised upon, industry standards. I think where Ms. Cobb is confused is there is no scientific reliability about bar fights. There's industry standards and tavern standards. And what the expert testified to was that this bar had no written security policy, had inadequate security bouncer training, did no background checks on any of the bouncers. Their policy for security was go ask the owner what to do when there's a fight, had no written record of any security instances to track that in terms of modifying behavior, and basically then allowed the intoxicated fighting patrons to be released into the parking lot, where further fights could occur. The argument, and principally the reason why we think that this case got to where it got, is because of the fact that this was a regular event, this crab feast, that 5,000 contractors went to right down the road. And this bar was nearby that knew that a whole bunch of contractors are going to come there after this crab feast, and we probably should have extra security. And during the course of the trial, there were a number of credibility problems that were exposed, frankly, through the testimony of the bar manager, that this was a regular thing and we should have extra security. And she testified that it was so busy she couldn't, she had to not be the manager, she had to bartend. They had one bouncer that night, and the owner said, we normally have 7 or 8 on a weekend night. And there were 50 more people than normal, already intoxicated, no one there to necessarily screen.
Now, in light of all of that testimony, and let's talk about the other issue, why should the manager of Happy Harry's or the police officer have been permitted to testify with regard to reputation?
Well, Your Honor, I think what it goes to show is that we tried to present testimony from all facets, not just employees.
I understand what you're trying to do. But what I want to do is focus on the trial where there are certain facts and issues and certain evidence that should be admissible. And what you have here is a fight in a bar. You've got an expert who testifies about how things should be done. And you have a manager testifying. What is the theory of admissibility for the manager of Happy Harry's or the policeman to testify?
Well, the theory, Your Honor, is based upon Rule 405, we're allowed to prove the character or the reputation of the bar. And the way we do that is, and I don't know if it was clear from the briefs, but Happy Harry's had a police officer that basically was stationed in the parking lot. And Happy Harry's paid for the police officer. And the police officer was there for a number of years up until March of 2002. This incident happened in June of 2002. And Mr. Stapiro, who worked occasionally on weekends, would indicate that that there were altercations, arguments in the parking lot. Mr. Garber, who's the owner of the bar, said, well, the way we dealt with our security problems is we just throw them out in the parking lot. Now, if the jury is going to get to the issue of is that an appropriate way to deal with fighting patrons, it gets to the question of do we need testimony from someone who had knowledge of about altercations in the parking lot?
Well, and my question is, how is that relevant at all to the facts of this case where the entire fight was in the bar?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think it gets to the issue of, and I believe that, and Judge Del Pesco was very careful in what she permitted me to ask questions, and that witness was scrutinized as well before he testified, that we were limited in time frame, and we were limited into what he could testify to, and I believe it's relevant. I think what the judge said was it's relevant based upon Rule 405 that you're permitted to testify about your personal experiences in terms of the reputation of a bar. And the fact the jury was entitled to know that they had a police officer in the parking lot because of, and the testimony from everybody was that this was a bar that had frequent fights. So it just goes as another example, and the relevance is, and, Your Honor, we did have
Well, stop and tell us what the relevance is.
Well, the relevance
That's
is
what Justice Holland
it means. Goes to the issue, frankly, of the character of the bar. And that's relevant. That's relevant to this case.
But how?
Because of the fact, Your Honor, that this is a bar that frequently had fights. And the argument made during trial by the defense was, a bar fight's a bar fight's a bar fight. And it's not foreseeable. What are you supposed to do when someone argues and you get a bunch of drunk people together, they're going to fight? And the reason why we brought in the neighbor of the bar is to say there were other problems. In addition to what goes on in the bar, there were problems in the parking lot. And we were a good neighbor. We hired a police officer. And that's relevant in terms of how the bar conducted itself. And we believe that's what Judge Del Pesco ruled in allowing very limited testimony by Witness Shapiro about that. Regarding the police officer, he was the investigating officer. And he testified, again, only in a limited time frame for about a 6-month time period, that he worked half of his monthly shift at night. And he also testified that it was one of the hot spots. And that was not a question that was elicited by me. It was during Judge Del Pesco's questioning of the witness. Before he testified in front of the jury, I want to know what the story is with his bar. And he testified that there are a few hot spots, and tailgates was one of them, which led him to believe that he knew sometime during that weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, there was going to be a brawl at that bar, and he was going to have to go deal with it.
I guess the record just confuses me, because in the way I read your theory of the case, this wasn't on a weekend. It was on a weeknight, and the reason they should have had the extra weekend security is because of the Crab Fest. And so if we're talking about evidence that's relevant to anticipating fights, all of the relevant evidence is there's a big event on this weekday down the street. It happens every year. You should realize you need at least the same security on this weeknight that you would need on the weekend. And then the manager talks about internal controls. I'm just having real trouble finding out how it's relevant at all that on some other time there were fights in the parking lot, or on some other time a police officer was called in on the weekend, when the theory of the case seems to be a fight on a weeknight following a big Crab Fest that they could have anticipated.
Your Honor, our expert testified that this Thursday night crowd, because of its size, was tantamount to a weekend night.
I agree. Let's suppose that you prevail in this appeal. Somewhere along the line, when we're writing the opinion, we need to be able to explain why this evidence was either admissible or inadmissible. And if it was inadmissible, it was either reversible error or it was harmless. And I want to be very candid with you. Under the circumstances of this case, I really don't see why it was admissible.
And I appreciate the court's comments about that. Your Honor, I do believe, and I have to tell the court, what we were trying to do at trial, and I understand getting to the relevance of it, is that when we had the manager testify, I certainly never expected her to say they had between 10 and 50 injured patrons in between January and June. And what the police officer was designed to have him testify to was the fact that he did investigate the accident and that he was familiar with the establishment and the reputation of it by his own personal experience. And the reason why I believe that Judge Del Pesco was right as to why that was relevant is the argument on the other side is the boys will be boys in bar fights, and there's a certain level that the defense articulates to the jury that this is supposed to be expected. And having a police officer who responds to those that says this was a regular occurrence just fortifies the argument that the plaintiffs made that the bar had a problem, knew it had a problem, decided not to do anything about it, despite the fact that the police came there on a regular basis. And I think that is something that the jury is entitled to know. And if the court is inclined to feel that is evidence that should not have been admitted, my position would be is that it's harmless error in light of the overwhelming testimony by the bar manager, by Mr. Garber, about the number of fights that existed there, and the bar manager specifically contradicted. Mr. Garber told the jury that he was there five or six nights a week. And then the bar manager testified that he was hardly ever there in the evening.
You're almost out of time, and nobody as of yet has discussed the post-trial status of the decision on additor and or a new trial. And what I would like you to tell me is why a verdict of $80,000 and change is something that shocks the conscience.
Your Honor, Mr. Baranowski was very seriously hurt. He suffered...
I understand that, and the $80,000 would cover all of his special damages.
To the penny, Your Honor.
And I understand.
And there are a number of cases that say that there's unrefuted permanent injury, pain and suffering. He had an atrophied arm that he showed to the jury, that if he's awarded just simply special damages, and there's no dispute about the extent of his permanent injuries, that is insufficient, based upon Delaware law, to compensate Mr. Baranowski for his pain and suffering and everything he went through.
And there is no recognition of the idea of a compromise verdict in Delaware?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there is. But my concern about the compromise verdict is Judge Del Pesco ruled pre-trial that Mr. Baranowski could not have been negligent. So the jury addressed the issue of liability, and then they went on to the issue of damages. Compromise verdicts arise when there's a dispute about liability and a dispute about damages, and they say, well, we won't give them everything in damages because we'll give them something in liability. Mr. Baranowski wasn't negligent. No one argued that or was permitted to argue that. The question was the bar negligent, yes or no? And if so, we get into damages.
Right. So there was a question about liability, right?
Right. I believe there was a question about
liability. There was a question about liability, and there's always a question as to what the level of damages should be. And arguably, the jury said, well, we're not so sure that the bar should be liable here, but this guy suffered serious damages, so we'll give him enough money to cover his expenses, and that's it.
Well, Your Honor, I just, in my sense of in participating in the case, I just don't believe that that was the thought process from the jury. Thank you.
In just the very few moments that I have left, I'd like to start where Mr. Nitschke ended. We don't know how the jury reached its conclusion in this case. We know some of the factors. We know that the case was regrettably submitted to the jury the day before Thanksgiving, relatively late in the afternoon. Whether that played a role, we don't know. We know that the jury did not ask a single question. The jury gave no indication that it misunderstood any of the judges of the jury charges. And the jury did not award anything to Mrs. Baranowski for loss of consortium. In a situation, and I agree with I think where Justice Berger began, I'm not aware of anything that says a compromise verdict is impermissible under Delaware law. Every verdict is a compromise in some fashion. It is I would expect that even in a conceded liability case, 12 jurors do not get to the table and all of a sudden decide first time around that the case has a value of X dollars. There has to be discussion. We encourage discussion. We encourage them to evaluate the case and to reconsider if they need to in an effort to reach a unanimous decision.
Let me interrupt. You're probably not the right person to be asking this, but where does it stand right now in terms of, as I understand it, the trial court said, I am granting a motion for additor or a new trial on damages only. Has a choice been made, or doesn't a choice get made until you find out what we do, or what?
Yes, Your Honor, we had to let the court know which route we would take, and we chose to take the appeal as opposed to a new trial limited to damages only, because we do feel so strongly that liability was very contested. In this
instance, the final judgment was entered for $200,000.
Correct. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. If I may return very briefly to the discussion about the reputation evidence, that evidence was not harmless error. That evidence was given by a Delaware State trooper of his opinion that this was a, quote, hot spot. On weekend nights, as opposed to the weeknight that this happened, he testified that he never arrested anyone there. He knew nothing about what went on inside the bar and had never even been inside the bar.
And what was the error in admitting it under 405?
Well, the reputation of the bar does not go to the crucial issue in this case. The plaintiff's theory in this case is that my client should have recognized that these two yahoos were going to escalate from a verbal exchange to a physical exchange, and Mr. Baranowski could have gotten caught in the middle. It is a question, pure and simple, of notice and reaction time. And that has nothing to do with the reputation of the bar. That has nothing to do with what occurred in the parking lot. That has nothing to do with what the manager of Happy Harry's seemed to think about the bar. And it certainly had nothing to do with what the Delaware State Police thought about the bar outside. And when you clothe that evidence, as you did Mr. Johnson's evidence, with this aura of expertise and authority, that's unduly prejudicial, and we think was a large portion of the way the liability case went the way it did. On the actual notice issue, there was no evidence that the reaction time of these bouncers, which was admittedly quick, as soon as it escalated to a physical confrontation, was insufficient. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Bye.